morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Tomorrow, April 19th, is the anniversary of American history's most famous horse ride. No, not the Lone Ranger's Hi-Ho Silver that galloped through early radio. The British are coming was the Revolutionary War cry of Paul Revere on April 19th, 1775, as he rode his horse through the early American night on April 19th, 1775, which began the first of the 18th century's two significant revolutions against aristocratic monarchies. The shot heard round the world. Perhaps the similarity between the examples of early American horsemanship is that the revered Paul Revere was by trade a Boston silversmith, and the Lone Ranger's famous horse was named Silver. And if indeed your memory is as slippery as mine is becoming with advancing age, the other notable revolution of the 18th century was that of France in 1789, most picturesquely remembered by the storming of the Bastille in 1789. I start today's program with something I wrote, The War on Taxism. American history boiled to the bone might be encapsulated as war and money rather than about rights, liberties, and equality. And the reduction might be further compressed if it is argued that the wars have all been fought for money, which would reconfigure the pursuit of wealth as the total fabric of the USA's manifest destiny. This perspective of history is obviously an injustice to those who have struggled and often been jailed, bled, or died for the larger beliefs relevant in the Bill of Rights. Yet the very fact of the intensity of the strife for equity and justice within our own Constitution gives legitimacy to the claim that for the powerful elite, money is the only mainspring of the nation's history. If indeed this narrow view of history has any credence, it must be realized that a select few have, from the very beginning, profited from the collective effort of the many. In this context, the term freedom is misapplied. Both politically and economically, free enterprise is a misnomer for the fact that throughout the country's 248-year history, the wealthiest Americans have, for the most part, accumulated and maintained their wealth at government expense, essentially through sales and subsidies, which can also be defined as the blood and taxes of the majority, who generally make possible but seldom share in the abundance. Newt Gingrich, if anyone remembers him, used to say, "The engine that pulls the train must be refueled." By that, he meant the new Tories of wealth and business should not share tax obligations with the common folk. Affluent taxpayers must receive breaks because they invest money and create jobs for others, Newt explained disingenuously, as if it had not been said before. In reality, those affluent taxpayers rarely invest in anything except their own stock portfolios, and they not only do not pay their fair share of taxes, they gorge on public money, which people like Gingrich call welfare, when it is distributed among the poor, and investment when extorted by the rich. At the same time, our political lords cut off welfare to single mothers and downsize workers. They initiate special tax breaks to favored corporations that amount to billions of dollars. They cut the taxes of big business, which invests a portion into the welfare of favored politicians, and the rich, who are shareholders in most of these same corporations, and spoil them with billions more in subsidies they claim are essential to the free market, which is regarded as a natural force. Public services and poverty programs are gutted to make up the shortfall. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer because the poor subsidize the rich. That is national tax policy. Corporations are, after all, inherently socialist rather than capitalist. Big business does not compete for sheer love of competition in an unfettered emporium of commerce, which is the myth of capitalism. The almighty free market is, in truth, the savage battleground to dominate the American economy in the bitter, ruthless goal of winner take all. The neo-Tories, quote Jefferson, twist him into a laissez-faire philosopher. Gingrich again, quote, when Jefferson said, every generation needs a revolution, he wasn't making an argument for chaos. He was making an argument for the creative replacement of the old order with a new order, quote, unquote. But old Tom's intent was to replace a repressive and corrupt colonial government with a truly revolutionary guarantee of power to the people. The new Tories' purpose is to return the USA to the vertically organized and patronage-dominated 18th century that the American and French revolutions blew asunder. Attempting to reestablish an old order of privilege and power based on wealth and property in this new millennium runs counter to Thomas Paine's vision of a decent and happy life for ordinary Americans who are assumed to be rulers rather than ruled. The plutocrats who control the major corporations claim the economy defines the nation more than its ideology. Money, they say, is the nation's ideology. What they mean by their strict definition of the economy is their own personal domination of the national wealth. In theory, everybody has an equal chance to make a buck and live the American dream. But of course, some are more equal than others. Narrow monetary policies that singularly benefit the upper layers of society draw money from the less well-off levels, which keeps them less well-off and always under pressure to pay what is demanded. Releasing public money, most of it pried from middle class and blue collar labor, to business and the wealthy elite is considered sound investment and essential to the economy. Providing public funds to the poor is regarded as uneconomical and a severe drain on the national treasury. Corporate culture is conditioned by commercial and public falsehoods that coerce the people to buy and pledge allegiance to America Incorporated, which transformed the American public from a democratic citizenry responsible for its rights, liberties, and pursuit of justice and equality to pre-adolescently avaricious consumers for whom only money and material possessions count. Ralph Nader says that a civic culture has been swarmed over by a corporate culture. The pattern of corporate dominance is as true for the USA today as it was for the Nazis and fascists early in the 20th century. Wage slashes and huge government subsidies and tax cuts. The Nazis and fascists maintained their grip on power by enriching their industrial patrons while tyrannizing the populaces of their nations. Corporations receive rebates on taxes they never paid and resent government intrusion, and that's a quote, into their affairs, criticizing regulations regarding their methods of business. However, They do not think government tax breaks or subsidies should be curtailed. The rupture between corporate profit and national economic growth is seen in the dependence of the private sector's profits in looting the public treasury, pillaging the natural environment, and reducing social services instead of developing new technology and enlarging markets through expansion of goods and services. Hundreds of millions of dollars are appropriated from important areas like healthcare and housing. The private plunder of the public domain extends to natural resources. Land, seabeds, and timber are stripped or despoiled without regard for long-term consequences. Eliminating millions of laid-off workers from employment necessitates huge welfare costs, which the wealthy who eliminate the jobs are not paying, leaving it up to already overburdened middle and working class taxpayers to pay. The U.S. gloats in its reigning superpower status and acts in the old Roman way, inflicting its immense capacity for war upon the world, which is its main offering to the new world order. But it is a defective colossus. Its economy is coming undone, the imperial fabric tearing apart due to its own internal rapacity, and the hundreds of billions of dollars of public money wasted on the military at the expense of its own internal civic disintegration in the holy names of defense, national security, must be paid for. Taxes will be raised from the humble and underfed. More money will be looted from already prostrate social programs, and heavy borrowing from other more cash-fattened nations will probably be essential to prop up and replenish our highly expensive military machine. The domestic decline of the United States is primarily the responsibility of the armed might that has bestowed its celebrated victories, the military-industrial complex, that one of its most fortunate and celebrated benefactors, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, warned the nation about when he left office several decades ago. This giant interlocking mafia of corporations and the military machine they built fashioned an American overseas empire. The nation was itself created and forged by war and an insatiable appetite for military power. War is the ultimate form of economic competition, Brooks Adams wrote at the beginning of America's reach for global supremacy. But the Pentagon's bloated budget has soared to a huge black hole into which everything is eventually drawn and disappears, such as the nation's wealth and resources, with neither replaced. The malign neglect of the huge and growing underclass that lives abandoned and without hope in the nation's crumbling inner cities and impoverished rural areas will eventually ravage the society more than foreign terrorists can ever hope to achieve, and will certainly give rise to domestic terrorism, if only for the purposes of survival. Millions of children live in poverty in the USA, most of them not white, which significantly lessens their chances of escaping destitution due to this country's prevailing racism. Dr. Charles Wilder, former director of Clatsop County Community Action Agency, once said that the war on poverty has become the war on the poor. The upward flow of the nation's wealth must be reversed, and the arid trickle-down become a flood if this trend is to be overhauled. The growing disparities in wealth and living standards undermine our society and threaten civil disorder on a massive scale, which presupposes a grim specter of the future worse than terrorism. Remedies for repairing our ravaged economy and reversing the intolerable social catastrophe it has precipitated are many, varied, complex, and depend on reapplying the nation's fundamental principles with fresh interpretations. The reestablishment of a union culture and radical reform of labor laws should be a primary goal for the good reason that labor and production are at the heart of economic and political recovery. But across-the-board tax reform that drastically reduces the military budget and eliminates the two-tiered tax system in which the privileged get most of the breaks and the rest of the citizenry pay the bulk of taxes should be a serious consideration of returning power to the people. I'm going to have to do that again because of that one word. Remedies for repairing our ravaged economy and reversing the intolerable social catastrophe it has precipitated are many, varied, complex, and depend on reapplying the nation's fundamental principles with fresh interpretations. The reestablishment of a union culture and radical reform of labor laws should be a primary goal for the good reason that labor and production are at the heart of economic and political recovery, but across-the-board tax reform that drastically reduces the military budget and eliminates the two-tiered tax system in which the privileged get most of the breaks and the rest of the citizenry pay the bulk of taxes should be a serious consideration of returning power to the people. The tax system must be reformed in favor of taxpayers. First, guaranteeing each an accounting of their money used by every level of government, and that basic returns for that money be automatic priorities, such as food, shelter, and health medical care. The present system of required payment of taxes without any accountability for their use by government must be reversed, which is possible with computerization of all public agencies. It will eventually be feasible in such a system that taxpayers have the legal power to determine where and how their tax monies are spent. Tax reformers usually attempt to allocate more tax monies to environmental and poverty programs, and many ideas are creative, such as energy and environmental taxes, as well as use and consumption taxes. Progressive taxation is the fairest redistribution of taxes from the wealthy to those most in need. But ultimately, only a strong and determined tax revolt by a large number of ordinary citizens will bring about adequate and necessary reform. The debate over income taxes is long-standing and bitter. Groups, both politically right and left, wish to abolish the current tax system, which they claim is unconstitutional, despite the superseding of original intent by the 16th Amendment. With the exception of the Civil War, Americans did not pay income taxes until 1913, and withholding taxes deducted from wages was a World War II innovation. The question of whether taxes should be collected under any circumstances might be answered that they be apportioned, raised, or lowered in consideration of the real needs of society rather than the corporate welfare the tax system has become. The real power for change is political revolt, which, if conducted by millions, could probably even subvert the extortion, as well as tyranny, of withholding paychecks before workers ever see them. It is quite probable the government would consider mass rebellion by taxpayers the worst conceivable form of terrorism and savagely respond with a campaign of extra-legal militant counter-terror, which is why any such revolt would have to occur in stages and obviously involve the courts, as well as simply refusing to file the forms and must appeal to the most fundamental doctrines of the nation. Paradoxically, the theory of progressive taxation might as well be Marxist. Each pays according to his or her ability, according to their needs and obligations. And that was the war on taxism. And now, from the New York Times, by Stephen Marche, the new movie, Civil War, matters for reasons different than you think. Not one man in America wanted the Civil War or expected or intended it, Henry Adams, grandson of John Quincy Adams, declared at the beginning of the 20th century. What may seem inevitable to us in hindsight, the horrifying consequences of a country in political turmoil, given to violence and riven by slavery, came as a shock to many of the people living through it. Even those who anticipated it hardly seemed prepared for its violent magnitude. In this respect, at least, the current division that afflicts the United States seems different from the Civil War. If there ever is a second Civil War, it won't be for lack of imagining it. The most prominent example arrives this week in the form of an action blockbuster titled Civil War. The film, written and directed by Alex Garland, presents a scenario in which the government is at war with breakaway states and the president has been, in the eyes of part of the country, delegitimized. Some critics have denounced the project, arguing that releasing the film in this particular election year is downright dangerous. They assume that even just talking about a future national conflict could make it a reality, and that the film risks becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is wrong. Not only does this criticism vastly overrate the power of the written word or the moving image, but it looks past the real forces sending the United States toward ever deeper division, inequality, a hyperpartisan duopoly, and an antiquated and increasingly dysfunctional constitution. Mere stories are not powerful enough to change those realities, but those stories can wake us up to the threats we are facing. The greatest political danger in America isn't fascism, and it isn't wokeness. It's inertia. America needs a warning. The reason for a surge in anxiety over a civil war is obvious. The Republican National Committee, now under the control of the presumptive nominee, has asked job candidates if they believe the 2020 election was stolen, an obvious litmus test. Extremism has migrated into mainstream politics, and certain fanciful fictions have migrated with it. In 1997, a group of Texas separatists were largely considered terrorist thugs, and their movement, if it deserved that title, fizzled out after a week-long standoff with the police. Just a few months ago, Texas took the federal government to court over control of the border. Armed militias have camped out along the border. That's not a movie trailer. That is happening. But politicians, pundits, and many voters seem not to be taking the risk of violence seriously enough. There is an ingrained assumption resulting from the country's recent history of global dominance coupled with a kind of organic national optimism that in the United States, everything ultimately works out. While right-wing journalists and fiction writers have been predicting a violent end to the Republic for generations, one of the foundational documents of neo-Nazism and white supremacy is the Turner Diaries from 1978, a novel that imagines an American Revolution that leads to a race war, written by an Oregonian, their writings seem more like wish fulfillment than like warnings. For those Americans of the 1850s who couldn't imagine a protracted bloody civil war, the reason is simple enough. They could not bear to. They refused to see the future they were part of building. The future came anyway. The Americans of 2024 can easily imagine a civil war. The populace faces a different question and a different crisis. Can we forestall the future we have foreseen? No matter the likelihood of that future, the first step in its prevention is imagining how it might come to pass and agreeing that it would be a catastrophe. And that was the movie Civil War Matters for Reasons Different Than You Think. And it was written for the New York Times by Stephen Marche, who is the author of The Next Civil War. This is Michael McCusker. Jack Harris is engineer for this program. Today, April 18th, is the date in 1945 that the great World War II newspaper war correspondent Ernie Pyle was shot and killed by a Japanese sniper on the island of Iwo Jima, just off Okinawa, the final campaign of that war that was climaxed with the advent of the nuclear age. Ernie Pyle was the most noted war correspondent since the ancient Greek Herodotus, who once wrote in one of his famous histories, "I am under obligation to tell what is reported, but I am not obliged to believe it." I was a USMC version of a war correspondent in the Vietnam War and paid homage to Ernie Pyle every day the year I spent at war. Ernie Pyle was my icon. And a final note, Patty Astor, whose family Astoria, Oregon, essentially owes its name, has recently died. She was 74. As with all Astors of note, she spent her life in New York City. She was an indie film star and co-founder of Fun Gallery in fabled Greenwich Village, where I lived once upon a time after Vietnam.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.